This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
All right, welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm Navy veteran Phil Briggs. This next segment, we're going to go from fighter jets in the air to deep under the sea as we talk about a unique partnership between Project Recover and Undersea Legion Services and their mission to discover and recover those missing in action around the world from underwater crash sites. And here to share with us more details about that and an exciting life of a very unique veteran is Project Recover President and CEO, former F/A-18 fighter pilot, Marine Corps Spec Ops veteran, Derek Abbey. Derek, how are you, sir?
Wonderful, Phil. Thank you for having me.
Indeed, man. And as a Marine, you're like a unicorn. You're like one of the rarest kinds of Marines I think I've ever met. What did you say you're called sometimes?
My buddy calls me a Wookiee. Sasquatch, kind of a unicorn, if you will.
Sasquatch, yeah. Because rare is the day you meet a Marine Corps veteran that started out, you know, kind of grunt style and then became a fighter pilot and then decided to go to a MARSOC unit, which the Raiders kind of got resurrected. And you're a new plank owner of one of the most elite and one of the rarest divisions in the military, the MARSOC, Marine Corps Special Operations Unit.
Yeah. My career was an absolute fairy tale. You know, I enlisted right out of high school and I just, you know, needed an escape. Really, my life was a little bit upside down and the Marine Corps was an organization I could run away to kind of get some stability and a system I could succeed in. And I definitely found that. I wasn't expecting I would do 23 years and see all the things that I saw, but it ended up being an incredible career and I owe my life to the military. They provided so much for me. I wouldn't be where I'm at with today without it.
Right on. All right. Before we get into going deep underwater and scuba diving to find MIAs and crash sites that have been lost to the sea for decades now, let's start a little bit, as you just kind of briefly touched on it.
Yeah.
F/A-18s I'm familiar with because I was a carrier guy. How do Marines do that? Did we let you guys just play with the jets on land or did you land on the carriers too?
Well, so I was an F-18 Wizzo backseater. So that's the F-18 Delta in the Marine Corps. So the 2-seat version of the F-18, the Marine Corps does both. They'll send squadrons to the Navy to work on and off of carriers. But the Delta is the 2-seat version. The Marine Corps controlled almost for the entire time that they had them, and they're in their twilight years now. And so they never sent the Deltas to the ship. Those are all land-based. Okay. They have ship capabilities. They could fly them on and off. You could do a launch and a trap easy. But the Marine Corps liked to keep control of them. So for the most part, we were flying off of out of all sorts of airfields all over the world. And for the Middle East, it was out of Kuwait and in Iraq and all around Afghanistan, things like that.
When you say two-seater, then is that similar to what some might remember from Top Gun and the F-14?
Yeah, they call them Rios in the F-14, and in the Hornet they call them Wizzos. So weapon systems officer. You do all the whiz bang stuff in the back, and you got another guy handling the controls. And yeah, it's a complicated mission, but I think it's the best, especially close air support, getting two minds together to work with people on the ground that are in dire needs. So got a chance to do a lot of that with a lot of soldiers, Marines, everybody that was on the ground in some pretty incredible situations. We got to work with them. That was definitely the favorite part of my mission, was doing close air support.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So in Top Gun terms, you were Goose.
Yeah. Yeah. Goose.
All right. I'm so glad it had a better ending. God love you. That's awesome. What was your call sign, if I can ask?
I was called Cosmo. And every call sign has a story. Mine's not too crazy, but you know, I was an enlisted communicator, then found myself in the F-18, and we were going on our very first deployment. It was OIF-1. It was getting ready to kick off, and you know, I'd been in the Marine Corps around a while, so I was a little bit more salty, although I hadn't had any combat experience yet. And so when we were taking off to Iraq, actually we were flying out of Kuwait, a lot of people were shaving their heads because we were living in austere conditions. And I just was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let my hair grow. And so I was letting my hair grow, and we didn't really have showers or anything. So it was a little bit out of control. And I was a new guy in the squadron. And we came back from a night mission one night, and we were having some food in the Air Force chow hall at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And one of the senior guys looks across the table at me and he says, you know, your hair is out of control. You look like Kramer from Seinfeld. So Cosmo Kramer. So they do a call sign reveal. Yeah. And then they put it to the squadron. Was it going to be Cosmo or was it going to be Kramer? And Cosmo won out. And so I'm forever known as Cosmo now.
That is awesome. I always love a good call sign story.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be something about your drink of choice, actually, when I first heard it.
I used to tell in my single days when I would be flirting with women, I'd say I had done some modeling in Cosmopolitan magazine. And for some reason, they never thought I was lying, which I'm like, would you look at me? I'm not a Cosmopolitan magazine person, but hey.
You were a foot model. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Well, I mean, look, anything to make a clean landing, right? I mean, when you're in a target rich environment, you got to use any weapon at your disposal. I'm with you.
That's right.
I'm with you. Okay. How the hell we go from fighter jets to MARSOC? That is one of the coolest units. I knew a guy, Nick Carnese, got a beard grooming product line out there. And he was talking to me about the MARSOC units. And from what I understood, it was like this elite special forces unit, but then special operations unit got disbanded or something like that. And then resurrected. And I mean, the recruitment video I saw for this thing going back to the 80s was just so rad. It looked like SEALs. I mean, part underwater, part on water, hanging upside down, swinging through trees, jumping off of helicopters. I mean,
it very much is. And World War II was when the Raiders were created, and they were an elite unit doing elite things at the time. And then after the war, it was disbanded. And so for a long time, after Special Operations Command was created, the Marine Corps didn't have a quote unquote special operations unit like the SEALs or the Green Berets or the PJs with the Air Force. But we always had force reconnaissance. So guys doing some pretty impressive stuff, what I call Smurf Ninja stuff, you know, doing all the snake eater work. But they never had a unit that was officially part of SOCOM. And so in 2006, 2007 timeframe, they stood up Marine Special Operations Command and created the Special Operations Arm within the Marine Corps of SOCOM and recreated, if you will, the Raiders. And so when they took down the force flag initially and put up the MARSOC flag, that's when I had a chance to join. And those units always have an aviator in their ranks to help with forward air control, you know, strikes and assets and things like that. And as it was being stood up, I had an interest in the special operations community just from the beginning of my career being a ground guy. You know, reconnaissance community was the elite. I didn't actually plan on going to the aviation side of things. I just kind of ended up in the aviation side of things and loved it while I was there. But when the opportunity to go join MARSOC or the Raiders presented itself, I jumped at it. So I went from ready rooms to team rooms and got to work with some incredible people and do some incredible stuff.
What was the transition like though? Because I think about you coming from like, you know, flyboy status. And I mean, at least the ones I saw on the carrier, you know, you guys were cool, but you know, there was a lot of cool haircuts. I didn't know about what was under the flight suit. Like if you guys were built out of steel and made of muscle. And then you're going with the ground pounders, the guys that are on the ground that are super fast, high speed, low drag, super fit, all muscles, all hustle. Did you have to train up to make it through the land nav part of the training or did you get picked on for being a soft guy? I mean,
no, I didn't actually. First, you know, the hair is just as cool. on the special operations side as it is on the aviation side. My Cosmo call sign fit in the Marsan community. But it was actually, believe it or not, very, very similar, because in fighter squadrons, in the aviation side of things, it's a bunch of people with a lot of type A personalities in those ready rooms that are people that are, you know, elite overachievers in their own ways. And so I left that ready room and, you know, checked in with this unit, and it was, you know, it just turned out that the tasks changed. And I think there was a lot of mutual respect across the communities, because the realization is that, you know, you can't half-ass this work and be successful.
Okay, before we get into going underwater and all the great work that you're doing, let me have one no there I was moment as an F-18 pilot.
Well, there was a lot of them. Just having the opportunity to work with people on the ground that found themselves in dire situations, whether that was the whole invasion into Iraq and doing the full push north as soldiers and Marines, you know, hightailed it to Baghdad. Or later on, Fallujah was really the second battle of Fallujah that I got to participate in. And we were basically developing urban close air support tactics in real time. And so being able to do that was just unreal. Really, I mean, we were taken off not too far. We were like 10 minutes from Fallujah. So we would take off, and there were a lot of cases that, you know, basically we were dropping our ordnance across the street from Marines that were in trouble. And that's danger close in those situations. And so typically when you do a nine line or an order, if you will, for close air support, the guy on the ground will give you the nine components of that order. And if it's within danger close, you have to ask for their initials, so they acknowledge that you're dropping ordnance close to them that could potentially harm them and others within their unit. And so it was happening so often that the Marines would give us their nine line and immediately follow it up with their initials, because it would just minimize the back and forth. And it was just one after another, after another, after another. But later on in that battle, after things started to slow down, there was a unique case that I remember distinctly. And this, like, basically a fire team of Marines was moving around, just kind of doing some patrols, if you will, at night, but they were by themselves. And there were enemy that were digging up caches in the area, weapons that they had buried, and these guys had spotted them, and somehow we get on the hook with this, you know, young Lance Corporal. And I could tell when he keyed his handset, he just couldn't believe that he was talking to an F-18, and it was nighttime, so he couldn't see us. And he was nervous because these guys were moving around and he wasn't quite sure where they were at. But he knew what building they were in. And so I had this, you know, laser that they could see on night vision goggles. And, you know, I just said, "Hey, we're here," kind of speaking regular words. You point out where he's at and we're going to take care of him.
Of course.
Yeah. I just distinctly remember his demeanor changed when we said that. And he's like, "Oh, okay. And then, you know, took care of the mission, and those guys went about their way and were able to continue through the rest of that battle without any incident. But it just made me feel good. And I wish I had that conversation recorded. It was on secure comms, but it was right. Just one of those things that I always reference it as a leadership example. Like, you know, if you can remain calm, it's amazing how calm is contagious. And
that is awesome. And then could you hear the cheers on the other end when like you dropped the building?
There were plenty of times where the Marines knew if they keyed the handset, and we could hear the ordnance coming in. And then, yeah, there was always a lot of high volume cheering and swearing and all sorts of celebrations after those occurred. But it always made you feel better. And just kind of like, I knew when we would come in and, you know, somebody would call for a show of force, basically. And, you know, sometimes you're kind of curious, do you really need a show of force? Is there somebody out there? And so the show of force would mean they just want us to come in low and fast and basically scare people that might be coming after them. But they would do that often and key the handset. And we were always happy to do that, whether there was an actual threat there or not.
Roger. Well, I got a Victor. We're a Marines at 3 degrees.
No, Private. Just tell me where the building is. You want me to explode, okay? Just point to it, and I'll drop it.
And that's pretty much the way it went.
Oh my God! Did you see that shit?
And then I had the luxury of being on the ground and experiencing it from the other side. And so I understand, you know, after you've been out on patrol for a while and you find yourself in one of those situations, having those aviators come through and make some noise that is truly the sound of freedom. You know, we used to say, you know, we're tucking your kids in at night. That's us tucking your kids in at night.
That's awesome, man. I love the smell of JP5 in the morning. Oh, yeah. All right. Okay. We could go on and on and on, but the story goes on and on and on. And this is, we haven't even scratched the surface, so to speak. A little nautical diving on there. Now, after the Marine Corps, he pursued his education at the University of San Diego. While earning a master's in higher education leadership, Derek conducted research on how universities and colleges work with military-connected students on their campuses, and his thesis provided best practices for colleges around the country to use in creating successful military programs. And he also went on to earn his doctorate, focused again on conducting practical research that would help make higher education more accessible to veterans. But it was a connection he made while still a young pilot with the Marine Corps' F-18 squadron that inspired him to continue to work to find our fallen heroes.
I was in the ready room one day, and this phone call came in, and I was the historical officer, so the duty officer just gave me the phone. Hey, Cosmo, hey, you answer this phone. And it was a World War II veteran on the other end of the line, George Burianic, and he's calling the squadron just to see if we had any contact information for World War II veterans. And it's like, you know, we don't really have those records, but what are you guys doing? And it's like, oh, we're having a reunion in Indiana. And it's like, really? He's like, yeah, we do this every year and we travel around the country. And I said, well, I want to come out there. It's like, yeah, you should come out. So me and a buddy took a jet out there and we joined the World War II cadre that were gathered. And, you know, we had just come back from Iraq. So they're like, tell us about F-18s in Iraq. And we're like, who cares about F-18s in Iraq? Tell us about Corsairs and World War II, you know? And they're like, who cares about that? But we just came together and bonded. And it was like, you know, time had passed. We were all young aviators from, you know, whatever time frame we were serving in, but made this connection. And they said, you have to meet this guy, Pat Scannon. He has this organization called the Ben Prop Project, and they go to Palau once a year searching for Americans missing in action from our previous wars. And it's like, well, that sounds really interesting. And so Pat and I ended up meeting the following year because I scheduled the reunion to happen in San Diego. So we brought the old World War II cadre to San Diego to meet with a new squadron. And him and I met that year and quickly became friends. And he invited me to go on a mission. And so at the time I was deploying quite a bit, but shortly thereafter, I made my way to Palau on my very first mission and was part of my very first discovery and MIA on my first mission. And as it turned out, it was actually a member of my squadron from World War II that we found. We found his Corsair. And so at that point, there was no turning back. And I just continued to participate in the organization as a member. And as we grew and had more and more success and more visibility and grew the nonprofit and partnerships with organizations like Scripps, Institution of Oceanography, and the University of Delaware, and others at Legion Undersea Services now. You know, I became a board member. And then when I finished my PhD, they asked if I would come over and take over as president and CEO. And that's where we are today. And, you know, we used to do one mission a year, every year in the South Pacific and the nation of Palau. And now we're doing multiple missions a year all over the world. We've been to 20 different countries now.
All you pilots, all you fly boys sitting around together, sharing stories about whose stick was bigger and you know, the whole no S there I was moments, I'm sure got passed around like the cold beers.
Yeah, lots of those.
So cool, man. So cool. What did it first look like when you were with this group?
That's a great question.
Were you guys like, were you donning the scuba suit and going out there with them? Or were you on the boats? Or were you doing like the mapping stuff?
The missions tended to be a month and we would do research throughout the year in preparation for those. And then we would search certain parts of the jungle and search certain parts of the water with the best information that we had. And it was pretty archaic. You know, the highest level of technology that we might've had was a GPS. But other than that, it was machetes through getting through the jungle and then scuba gear, basic scuba underwater. And we found success. You know, we were finding these sites and documenting them and turning them over to the Department of Defense. And then ultimately people were being repatriated.
Welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. For ConnectingVets.com, I'm Navy veteran Phil Briggs. And we'll return to our conversation with Marine Corps veteran, retired Major Derek Abbey, who after a career in both aviation and special operations, is still going on unique missions around the world as the president of Project Recover. Only this time, the missions are to locate crash sites and repatriate our MIA service members. We talked about what it's like searching for clues from historical battles that have been buried at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean for decades.
Were these dive sites that like locals already kind of knew about and they were like, hey, we'll take you to Bayman. We'll take you out to, you know, whatever it is, the we call this one the tail hook or something. And it's like, or were you guys literally discovering like virgin sites that no one had seen and fuselages and plane parts that had been on the bottom of the ocean since that fateful day during World War II?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question because Palau is a world-renowned scuba diving location. But the truth is, no, we definitely weren't diving, you know, the pristine, beautiful places where everybody is traveling to and all known about. There's something special about Palau and why the work started there. Very, very small island community, you know, about 20,000 people, population, multiple islands, not very developed since World War II, especially at that time. And so the jungles were relatively untouched. The waters and lagoons around the islands were relatively untouched and relatively shallow that we could scuba dive in those areas. But the places that we were searching were not. They were the murky water, the low visibility. No tourist was going and hanging out there. Same thing with the jungle. We're hiking deep into the jungle, you know, just using our feet. And we would connect with local hunters and fishermen that would know sites. And possibly like, oh, there's some aluminum over here, but they didn't necessarily know it as an airplane or things like that. And when we first started doing the work, you know, they thought we were treasure hunters and things like that. They're like, oh, these guys are, you know, what are they doing? They're off in the middle of nowhere. Nobody goes to those locations until we started finding sites. And then the locals really connected with the message and the value of it. They believe in Palau about when somebody dies, they are returned to the island of their mother. And so when they realized that we were looking for and finding service members that were ultimately going to be repatriated back to their loved ones in the United States, they made a connection to it on multiple levels. One, the cultural connection of the importance of bringing somebody home, but also they have this deeply felt gratitude for the sacrifice of American service members that gave them their country back from World War II. And so it was a really neat connection to see that happening. And sometimes when I talk about this work, we talk about the healing impact that occurs from the individual level all the way to the national level. And we understand that very much so from the American side of things through our direct connection to it. But then there's this parallel side of impact that happens in the host nation. And we've seen that many times over in Palau, where people were, you know, my family would talk about this. There was this oral history about this loss. And, you know, the truth is my father, who's since passed, was telling the truth. And I was able to share that message with you. And then we found the site. And so that healing occurs from them. And it's unbelievable, you know, these wounds that are held decades and decades later from a war like World War II and others.
Mm. So cool. Walk me through just one of your memorable dives where you found something and then connecting with the family on the back end.
Yeah, it's an accomplishment. And the feeling is very similar across the board, whether it's on land or in the water. You know, you finally see the site, and we've done so much research up to that point. We're almost 100% positive once we find a site that it is who we're looking for. You know, there might not be another aircraft in that area, or we've triangulated enough information to know that this is the aircraft. Of course, we're not 100% there yet as far as knowing, but we know. And so, yeah, there is, you know, the biggest thing is the propeller underwater. You know, usually these sites are mangled and broken and in different. You might not recognize them as airplanes when you first see them. But one thing that's pretty common on these sites is, you know, that propeller sticking out of the ground. And in many ways, it's a grave site. And so the realization is that, yes, we found this. We've been successful in locating this site. Answers are going to be provided. So all that all that just floods into your mind. You know, underwater, you have to be mindful that you're still underwater and you're diving, and you have to pay attention to scuba diving. But you, this flood of emotions definitely comes over to you, and it's very, very personal for everybody on the mission. And I know definitely for me, and I know my other teammates too, there's always this point of just kind of reaching out and touching that propeller or other pieces of the aircraft that just remind you that this is real, and these answers are going to be provided to the family members. And, you know, many times the families, most of the time the families don't even know that we're looking. And so we're collecting these answers that are ultimately going to be delivered to them. And you asked about that, what happens when, you know,
I was going to say, give me one, like, again, no shit, there I was moment when you found a plane and were able to identify some way, somehow, who that was and what plane that was.
Yeah. The one that comes to mind is actually a land site. And it was that first mission that I told you, because we were looking for this Marine Corsair, and we were in this super, super thick jungle. It was the only aircraft in the area that was lost. So if we can find it, you know, that's going to be it. And we knew it was in this mangrove jungle. And but if you've ever worked in mangrove jungle, it's almost impossible to move through. I mean, you can lose your direction. The sun will get blocked out. It's very, very hot and thick. And so we just decided, you know, we're gonna look in this jungle for a little bit. And we started venturing out, and we had some handheld radios. And my colleague, Joe Maldangasang, who's a local Palauan and our translators, and he's one with the jungle and one with water. And he comes over the radio and he says, you know, I think I have something you're looking for. And I could hear him when I yelled out to him, but I couldn't quite see him. And he was maybe 50 yards away, if that, maybe 50 feet away. And I started trying to make my way through there toward him as well as the other members. And we're trying to hack our way through. And I think I did a full circle around him before I actually got to him, because the jungle was so thick. And then once we got there, the only thing that he had was a feed tray to a 50 cal machine gun from the aircraft, but it was aluminum. It was a feed tray. It was definitely aviation. And so it was that moment that we knew that we found this aircraft. And so we came together, and then we just started spreading out from there, and we found more and more and more of the aircraft, and then ultimately got to an identifying piece of the aircraft that we knew which type of aircraft it was. And at that point we could triangulate, you know, information and become with a 99% solution that this is the person that we're looking for. So now fast forward a few days later, where we were interviewing an elder and who lived close by, and he starts telling us a story of when he was a kid and he was alive during World War II. And he's like, oh, right over here by this hill, you know, the Japanese were there, and I hid into this ditch, and he watched this aircraft go down. And we had not said anything about this aircraft that was lost. And he said, it went down in this mangrove over there. And he was talking about the aircraft that we had just found. And we hadn't told him anything, no leading questions or anything like that. And so then we asked him, well, did the Japanese go in afterwards to try and go after the aviators? And he says, oh, no, it's too thick. And so we asked him, well, has anybody else gone in there since World War II that you've seen? And he's like, no, you have to be crazy to go into those mangroves. And then we told him the story of going in and finding this aircraft that we had found a few days later. And he thought we were the craziest people around. But yeah, that story was actually a member of my squadron. So that's definitely near and dear to my heart, and one that's going to be stuck in my mind forever. It was the first aircraft I was a part of locating, member of my squadron, you know, all these things that had to come together and to include a lot of luck. I'll still remember picking up that feed tray and just realizing this is it. This is the, we found the aircraft. And that's a similar feeling since then when we find other aircraft. It's like, this is it. We found it. We have success. This is going to turn into, you know, something incredible for the loved ones of this service member. They're going to have answers to questions that they've been holding for decades. And, you know, healing's going to be able to occur, and some celebrating is going to occur. And
yeah, some joy, because they actually have an artifact now that connects them to, you know, generationally speaking, this is now the grandkids or the great grandkids.
You know, I say people go through three phases when they join our organization. The initial phase is, you know, they hear about it and they believe in the mission, they want to participate and support, and they become a member. They go through the process and they become a member, and then that's the first phase. And then they start going on missions, and they reach the second phase when they participate in a discovery. And now this whole thing that you've been working for is real. You know, that this is actual real. These sites have been lost and we found them. And so that's a whole nother level of commitment. And then the last one is when that MIA is repatriated and you have an opportunity to connect with the family. And you can, there's no way to accurately put it into words. But you see this impact of the work that you've been doing, and you get to witness that. And like I said, these memorials and celebrations, that whether it's Arlington National Cemetery or small town USA across the country, they're all unique, but also very similar in the same way. And so you get to see that, you know, these people didn't have answers, and now they have answers to these long held questions. Many times they've made up stories that weren't necessarily accurate, but now they had the factual information of what happened to their loved one. And you get to witness that legacy and share that legacy with them. There's been many times where I think of service members, you interact with their family, and they have this long tradition of service in our military to this day. And every one of them has been sat down when they were making their decision to join the military and told, you know, you live up to this legacy of your family, you know, uncle or grandfather or whomever it was lost in World War II and is still lost and sacrificed on our behalf. And so this is the legacy that you have to live up to. And they've told us that story. And it's absolutely amazing. And then so then that's the third phase. People get to that point and it's just like, oh my goodness, you know, now you have a legacy that you've created. To have this wave of positive impact across our nation through bringing somebody home, and their sacrifice was made in World War II or whenever it was. And now there's another wave of positive impact from that sacrifice when they come home, and these communities come together and start connecting, and, you know, trust is reestablished with our nation and things like that, for this promise that was made to those families that, you know, if they were lost in battle, we'll do everything that we can to bring them home. And so then now we have seen and continue to see that these families, we've had members of families come forward and say, you know, you just did this on your own accord. How do I pay this forward? And so now we have Gold Star family members of people that we've worked to repatriate them. Now their family members are members of our organization.
So cool. A question out of order, but just that's right. A quick answer here on this one. How is it that you're able to determine who and what plane that is when you come across a site with something as minimal as a feed tray to a 50 cal or piece of a propeller? Like, how do you know what plane and what pilot that was?
Yeah, well, it all starts, this whole mission starts with research. So we comb the archives for information, you know, after action reports and everything like that, that are held in the archives, and create cases from those. And then we also do interviews with family members, fewer and fewer World War II veterans or eyewitnesses now, but family members, and they could potentially have information in some of these trunks that are sitting in people's attics and things like that, notes from the war. And we take all that information, compile that, and then we make decisions on where we're going to do the missions based on the information that we have. And we'll comb through all of those things. You know, we started to build a database that has hundreds of cases associated with thousands of missing Americans, and we'll prioritize those based on likelihood of success. And then we'll execute those search missions. And those search missions could be in the water, they could be on land. We do a lot of work in the water today because there's been less and less work that has been done in the water, and also working with some of the most amazing scientists in the world from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the University of Delaware and others. We can use their automated underwater vehicles to comb the ocean floor and collect side scan sonar information and other information, and then look for, you know, potential targets or points of interest, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so we can dive those more safely, or if they're deep, we can use a ROV to inspect those, to see if they're aircraft or not. And then once we do that, once we find a site, we'll do everything we can to identify what type of aircraft. And then two the point of the exact aircraft. And that can be done through finding identification plates or other things like that. And sometimes you can't do that. So then you have to do, well, how many planes were lost in this area? How many were this type of aircraft that we found? If there was only one, well, now you've narrowed it down. It's not 100%, but you're pretty obvious. And if you can find certain plates or certain identifying information, then we know exactly which aircraft it is. And once we know exactly which aircraft it is, we know who the air crew were, whether they're missing or not. And then we'll document all that information. Traditionally, what we have done is we've documented all that information and then turned it over to the Defense POW MIA accounting agency or the predecessor organizations. And then they would assess that information and determine whether they were going to do a recovery mission. We still do that, but now our mission has expanded into the recovery phase. In 2015, DPAA had gone through a restructure. And when they did that, they opened the organization up to public-private partnerships. So we had an unofficial relationship with them before, where we would feed them information. But now we have an official relationship with DOD that allows us to expand our mission to recovery and actually recovering remains and artifacts and then transporting them back to the United States. Typically, they go to a lab either in Hawaii or in Nebraska, and that's DOD locations, and they have to do the blind identification of remains when those are recovered. Title 10 restrictions ensure that has to occur in those labs. So that's the only thing in our mission that, or in the entire spectrum of the mission that we don't do, is the official identification of remains.
And those are remains, when you say remains, it can be those of a plane, like mechanical pieces, or when you say remains, you're speaking to our fallen service member.
Yeah, osseous material, you know, what typically bones and things like that. That's usually the only thing that's remaining. You can and will bring back other artifacts that will help with the identification, of course. So, I mean, obvious things like a dog tag or rings or other personal effects. When you find those help with the identification. Believe it or not, you know, most people go straight to DNA as probably the primary identifying piece, but that's just one. They still use a lot of dental records. There's very well kept dental records from that time that they can still use. They do use DNA, but then they use everything to, you know, use as much information as they can to make sure they're as positive as possible. And, you know, the families are notified that their loved one was located and identified and has been repatriated. And now they have the option to do everything that goes with anything, you know, full military honors. And typically that's the point when, they're introduced to the work that we did to find their loved one. Mm.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, starting with like the genealogical almost research of the mission to go back through the mission data on the records, the after action reports, finding where the likelihood of success would be to locate aircraft, and then getting deep either into the jungle or into the water and finding it to find the actual material pieces. And then the back end, with the CSI laboratory kind of stuff going on. Just an amazing, amazing mix. And it's only growing here, which is what brings us to, you know, sticking the landing, so to speak, but brings us to where we started. And that is your now partnership with Legion Undersea Services, which sounds like, I admit, when I first heard it, I thought it was like superheroes. Like it's you and Aquaman and, you know, other superheroes of the deep that can go down and do, you know, Mission Impossible. But share with me a little bit about that partnership and why it's just so damn cool.
Yeah, well, you know, I definitely look at those guys as superheroes because they're very incredible people, and they bring an expertise that really expands our mission. And, you know, in 2012, when we started working with Scripps and UDell, you know, our mission just exploded in capability because of the technology and things that they were bringing to the table. And so when we started going into the recovery phase and realizing that we were going to do recovery underwater, you know, we started looking at how do we do this at the highest level possible, the right way, the safest way, that's going to result in success. And that's, you know, bringing these missing service members back to their family. And we were introduced to some Navy divers that, you know, talk about the highest level of success is that these men, for the most part, have committed their life to living underwater and doing work underwater in the highest level of capability. And so we started working with them and really discussing how to execute this mission at the highest level possible, the safest level possible. And realizing through those discussions that, you know, these people that we're talking with are on the same level as we are as far as commitment and belief in the mission. And maybe we should make this a long-term relationship. And so, you know, we asked for a call with them after kind of interacting with them for a while. And initially we were just talking about, we're going to do this one mission together, but we were so impressed with the capability that they were bringing and how they were going about their planning and preparation. And it filled us with so much confidence that, you know, we said, well, let's get on a call and see, you know, what, if they're interested in some sort of long-term commitment. And, you know, I think once the words came out of our mouth, like, hey, we'd really like to work with you guys long-term, it was a fraction of a second in response that this is exactly what we want to do, you know? And so they're former Navy divers. So they understand the importance of bringing lost service members home, and you can ask them across the board and they'll say, this is the most fulfilling mission that they could participate in. And many of them, when they were active duty, had actually participated in this mission through the Department of Defense, through the DPAA and the predecessors. And so, and some of them have actually done recovery on sites that we located. So it was really neat to see, hey, now we come together later on down the road. And so we've established that official relationship with Legion Undersea Services because, you know, we think they're the best in the business. We think that they're going to, well, they do expand our capability to execute this mission at the highest level possible underwater in the safest way possible. And, you know, there's no learning that's going to occur, or there is learning that's going to occur, but it's going to be minimal. It's going to be right to it. Yeah. And so we're excited to get into the field with them this summer and start bringing some missing service members home together. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to be the ones in the water, doing the heavy lifting underwater, really, literally and figuratively.
Yeah. And last question is, what does that exactly look like? We talk about expand the capability and everything. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, you and I kind of understand operations, but for the layman, like, what is it that they're actually doing? Do they have underwater unmanned vehicles you'd mentioned? Do they have massive cranes that can pull these huge pieces of fuselage or whatever out of the water? Like, what does it look like, what they do?
Yeah, the biggest thing that they bring is the expertise and the understanding on how to do this mission underwater, given all the variables, which all the variables are going to change depending on the mission. So how deep is it? What kind of aircraft is it? Is it going to require, you know, moving big chunks of metal around? Is it going to require just digging or, you know, using these big suction devices underwater? What kind of diving technology are they going to utilize? Is it rebreather technology? Is it tech diving? Or in the case that we're working on right now, they're using surface supply options. So their capability and understanding and be able to take all those variables into account and execute the mission safely and efficiently is the biggest thing that we work for. They have, you know, between them, hundreds of years of service in working underwater, and they continue to do this in different capacities. So for the most part, they were, you know, doing underwater work as contractors. So, you know, somebody gets drunk and sinks their boat in some lake in Kentucky, well, their insurance, that person's insurance company hires them out to bring their boat off the lake floor or something. So they understand how to work in that environment, lift heavy things, move things underwater, things like that, where that's way beyond just searching, you know? So, and there's, when you're exerting yourself underwater, there's other things to be aware of as far as how the physiology works with your body when you're working with certain gases at certain depths and things like that. And so those are very, very varsity things. You know, that's just not for the layman diver to come off the couch and say, yeah, like, I can do that. You know, definitely not. You need people at the highest level possible to do that. And the most important thing is to do this safely. You know, so, you know, we don't want to risk the life or lose the life of somebody on a mission looking for somebody that's unfortunately since passed. And so that's something that's the highest priority for us. And they bring the highest capability of doing that and doing it the right way. And so it just made the most sense to do it. So they come with a variety of expertise from, you know, how to cut through metal, underwater at certain depths to how to execute this mission, exerting this much energy over this long a period to do it in the safest way possible. And that's what they did. So it's a lot of beeps and squeaks and a lot of looking at charts and understanding all that stuff about it. But that's why we bring them in, because they are the smartest in the business when it comes to it.
So cool. A beautiful story, the way you're able to find these and, you know, again, bring home the legacy of somebody's fallen relative. Derek, tell me a little bit more about where I can find more information and make a donation to the organization Project Recover.
Yeah, the best thing to do is go to projectrecover.org, and you can find out more and more information, find some stories about some of the service members that have been repatriated, how we go about our work in different ways, all sorts of things like that. And of course, if you want to make a donation, you can make a donation there. We also want to hear from people that might have information related to a lost loved ones. They can reach out to us through our website to provide information.
Very cool. Derek Abbey, from fighter pilot to MARSOC raider to deep under the sea and repatriating our MIAs. Can't thank you enough. So great, man.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
All right, so that does it for this week's show. Thank you for listening. Now, we'd love to hear from you, so follow us on Twitter at IonVeterans, or you can reach me at PhilBriggsVet. I'm always down to get your hot takes and spicy memes, and I'd love to talk to you every week, so please like and subscribe. Hell, even give us a review of the show, because the comments and reviews really help us tailor the show to you. Again, I'm Phil Briggs, Navy veteran and reporter with ConnectingVets.com in Washington, D.C., and I look forward to talking to you again on another episode of CBS Audio's Eye on Veterans.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Eye on Veterans ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.